Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, you're listening to Let's Eat In. Today's show is at Heritage Radio Network, as usual, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. And today's show is all about cozy, comfort, winter-appropriate food. I know a lot of people are now looking to some favorite comfort food recipes, maybe from their heritage passed down from the family. And I can think of few things that really soothe my soul as much as stuffed cabbage, and that happens to be a popular dish in Poland. So today I'm very excited to chat with one of the authors of a new cookbook called From a Polish Country House Kitchen, 90 Recipes for the Ultimate Comfort Food. And we have Danielle Crittenden, an author, co-author based in Washington, D.C. on the line. How are you?
Hi, Kathy. I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being on the show. And I know that you had, you know, you've been a storied journalist. You mentioned in the introduction you mostly write about women's issues and that you're an unlikely cookbook author.
That's right. And my co-author as well is, as you know, Anne Applebaum, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. So we are both very unlikely cookbook authors.
But very likely writers in any sense. So how did you fall into this project?
Well, we did literally fall into it, and actually Anne got kind of bullied into it by me.
Mm-hmm.
We both love to, in our professional lives as journalists, I'm in Washington, and she's married to Radek Sikorski, who's the Polish foreign minister, and she's also been a historian, a well-known historian, obviously, of Eastern Europe. So she has lived between Poland and London and the United States. And in that life, both of us love to cook and we love to entertain.
Mm-hmm.
And so this cookbook idea arose from a visit that took place with some of her American friends, including me, going and visiting this country Polish manor house, which
wow.
is what the title is from,
yeah.
that she and her husband rebuilt pretty much from the ground up right after communism there fell. And It was so remarkable what they had done, both with the house and also with what had happened to Poland and Polish cuisine in those 25-plus years or whatever it has been since the fall of communism. And so when we were over there visiting her in this house and seeing Poland for the first time, I'd been there mm-hmm. once right after communism fell.
Oh.
It was just so extraordinary that we felt one of the best ways to capture it would be through its cuisine, through its cooking.
And you really dig deep. I mean, you go through the history and talk about how, well, you mentioned that the years of communism did not enhance its reputation, that is Polish cuisine. And but you get back to the heritage before and how rich and fascinating it is and how many people were reliving it and reviving this really rich cuisine.
Well, I think there are two ways of looking at Polish cuisine that we have, especially as North Americans. There's the Polish cuisine that came through immigrants at the turn of the last century and has been with us.
Polish-American cuisine, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So we think of it, and I think our associations with it are quite heavy. Pierogies,
mm-hmm.
cabbage rolls you mentioned, but very heavy, you know, pork stuff ones and sauce.
Kielbasa, maybe.
And some of it also very Jewish-based cooking, too, it derives from Poland because so many of the Jewish immigrants who came from that part of the world. And then there was anyone who traveled in a communist country, really anywhere, during the Cold War would be confronted, you know, whatever the officials were telling you about the culture, that you'd be confronted with the incredible shortage of food. And Poles suffered like everybody else did. and their cuisine suffered. And I joked to Anne, you know, there's always been a farm-to-table movement here in Poland because for a lot of that time, if you wanted fresh vegetables or fresh meat, you cooked it or you hunted it yourself.
Foraged.
So a lot of that food got in shortage, got lost. And once Poland is one of the countries, few countries in Europe right now, that is really thriving economically and in so many ways, so they've been able to, you know, go back in time and restore a lot of traditional Polish cooking, which is familiar in some ways to us, but I guess my own North American interest in it was, but also much different and much more interesting than what we associate it with over here.
It's fascinating. You mentioned about, you know, having to forage for many ingredients, and I saw throughout the recipes quite a lot of wild mushrooms being used, and oh, it sounds so wonderful. And it's kind of funny because wild mushrooms are one of the most expensive things if I were to splurge at the grocery store to find, but this was actually a result of you know, pure necessity.
Well, also, they grow so plentifully, and Poles themselves have learned, you know, even our photographer, we could run out to the vegetable garden when we were photographing the book and, like, pull, you know, arugula or a potato from the garden if we needed it. And I looked at Anne and I said, how many New York photographers could, you know, could run out to the garden and know exactly what the plant was and how to get it? So, yeah, Poles do that. And the mushrooms, if you look in our book, that we have a picture of all these fresh wild mushrooms. And the chanterelles, I mean...
I was just about to say.
It could be like $200 at a farmer's
market. I am looking at this like beautiful photo. So in this photo of like 200 or so mushrooms, did you just pluck those?
Yeah, actually. Oh, they came into us. And but I think what the sort of interest is, obviously we use recipes. Part of my role in this cookbook was to North Americanize the recipes to make sure that, yeah, we weren't asking you to have $200 of fresh chanterelles in a recipe. You can get dried ones and they work really, really well.
Right.
And they're less expensive. But that kind of exotic, so even the pierogies or the cabbage rolls were different in this way. And actually really also surprisingly healthy. That was also one of the great surprises for me, was in Polish, cabbage rolls are known as galabki, which means little doves.
And
North American person would call a cabbage roll little dove. You'd think of it like a fat pigeon or, you know. But a little dove, no. And in fact, when you go over there, not only are they much more delicate, more somewhere between a spring roll and what we think of as a cabbage roll, but they are also filled with different things. So in our case, sometimes they're filled with veal. In our case, we have a recipe which uses chicken and rice.
Mm-hmm.
You can put them in a light tomato sauce, but you can also, as we did, put them in a wild mushroom sauce.
Yeah,
and same with the pierogies. They're more like dim sum. You know, you can get the classic heavy cheesy thing, but a lot, when you go to these little pierogerias, you can get wild mushroom and sauerkraut. We have a recipe for a duck pierogi.
Oh, yum. Wow.
You can make them smaller. You know, they don't have to be these enormous hockey puck-like things.
Wow.
So that was what was really fun, was to take these dishes and play with also the different flavors that you get over there, like mushrooms and beets, but also vinegars and pickles and mustards and horseradishes and all those flavors.
Yeah, there's a lot of pickles and preserved foods throughout Polish cooking, and also a lot of beets. I'm looking at this recipe right now. There's beet soup three ways, and then there's summer beet soup, or barshk, which we associate normally with borscht, the Russian version. But it really is... it just means beets, correct? And it could range from all sorts of different types of soups.
Well, the summer beet soup, which is chudnik, pronounced chudnik, I learned a little tiny bit of Polish, was one of the most arresting recipes, like to me, that I came across as sort of the North American who was unfamiliar with it. And it's like a Polish...
gazpacho?
Gazpacho, okay. Exactly. So you take fresh summer beets and you chop them up in little cubes and you mix it with cucumber and dill and some fresh yogurt or kefir, and you stir it all up and you let it sit overnight, and it's this beautiful creamy soup that's sort of pink and streaky and very fresh, crunchy, flavorful. And they sometimes, and this is another neat sort of Polish custom that they do with a lot of soups, they'll put a fresh boiled egg in it.
Yes, I've seen that beautiful photo.
Right, so you're going through the soup and then suddenly there's an egg there, and mm-hmm. you think, oh, actually this is a really good idea.
Yeah, a lot of richness there to add to it. I know that recipe sounds just standout, wonderful, and I can see it being on the menus of lots of, you know, new American restaurants around here. It has all that fresh flavors and just pure ingredients.
Well, right, like the Italian, you know, when we rediscovered in North America Italian cooking, that, you know, in the 50s, mm-hmm. if you walked into an Italian restaurant, it'd be spaghetti and pizza and that kind of thing, and then suddenly there's this whole Tuscan movement, mm-hmm. and a lot of it has come from very poor, you know,
traditions, yeah.
Poor traditions, because they've had to take some very simple ingredients and really extend them and make them work. And suddenly, you know, pasta isn't all covered with heavy meat sauce because meat was just not that plentiful.
Right.
And same with Polish cooking, is that these are people that, aside from whatever economic circumstances they've lived through, they've also, you know, they have, it's a wintry, long winter coal culture. So you really lean heavily on things you can preserve, and you lean heavily on things like root vegetables. So there are a lot of cabbage recipes, roasted root vegetables, soups that you can sort of keep, soups and stews that you can kind of keep going for days on the top of your, you know, stove. But done in so many different and interesting ways that's we found, just especially sort of if we step back into our roles as modern American women with families, they really adapt well to modern family life because, A, they're very simple. They don't use too many exotic ingredients, but they're things that you can sort of start in the morning and leave, or assemble sort of quickly after school, but are very sort of family-oriented type cuisine.
That's a fantastic point, actually. Yes, I find that, you know, and also they're very economical. They tend to be cabbage, beets, roots. I find a lot of folks at the farmer's market or picking up their CSA not sure what to do with the turnip or, so the cabbage. And I feel like this cookbook really speaks to a lot of new ways that, not new ways, actually, traditional ways that are just so practical and so healthful, as you mentioned. It's funny. How do you think, or why do you think a lot of these traditional cuisines were translated into the U.S. with such a heavy tome instead?
I think a lot of it to do, frankly, was prosperity. That when these immigrants came to North America, and as, you know, as we were saying earlier with the Italians, that suddenly meat is plentiful. And cheap, you know, suddenly all these ingredients that you had to either forage out of your own earth or, you know, buy very expensively at the local market, suddenly you come to the North American economy and culture and it's all plentiful. So, yeah, suddenly you're putting 2 pounds of meat sauce on your spaghetti.
And they're on
you're
a
making enormous cabbage rolls.
And a honeymoon phase with meat.
Right. Yeah. And it's going back... And then a lot of it becomes sort of homogenized too. That you know, you lose those original notes of flavor. One of the sort of biggest hits of our book, like when you talk to people who are cooking their way through it,
mm-hmm.
they love the pickle soup. We didn't call it pickle soup. We probably should have called it pickle soup, but it sounded so weird. So we called it sour cucumber soup. And I don't even know that sounds any better. But my kids, my kids were over with us when we were photographing the book, and they just went nuts for this stuff.
Oh, wow.
But the pickle soup is basically a potato vegetable soup with the pickle element that you kind of grate up and you use some of the brine in it. Just makes it more, it doesn't taste like a pickle. It tastes like an intensely dill, you
oh,
know,
wow.
an intense dill-flavored potato vegetable soup, and it's very hearty, and it's filling, and it's very comforting. But it's also different from what you're used to tasting in a kind of potato soup.
Oh,
the kids
wow.
always beg me to make that for them.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know about that one, but it sounds a lot like the kimchi stews I've been making lately. So let's keep on this conversation, and we're just going to cut to a quick little musical interlude. We'll be right back talking with Danielle Crinden.
You're listening to Never in Love by the Four Lincolns on the heritageradionetwork.org.
We met that night. I caught you in the light, shining down like a miracle. You look like Apollo, like someone I could follow into battle over my heart. There's hope between us. I just cannot believe this. Someone else.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
All right, we're back with Danielle Crittenden, the co-author of Polish Country House Kitchen, and I really love how evocative the title is, and you definitely see it throughout the beautiful photos in this book, so congratulations. It's a revelation, I think. What's your favorite recipe, Danielle, in the book?
Oh, okay, well, we just talked about one, which was pickle soup. I like so many of them, but the other two sort of standouts, and I'm going this also through my children and what they keep asking me to make and make again. One is a recipe that actually, this one came through my husband's Jewish grandfather who descended from Poland.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to say every night he would eat, you know, boiled chicken. And there was nothing better in this world than boiled chicken. And we hear that and you go, disgusting, you know. Now, if you substitute the word poached for boiled, suddenly it becomes a different creature. And going through some of these old Polish recipes that Anne sent me, she found an English language, very traditional Polish cookbook from like the 1950s. I was going through it, and I come across this recipe for this kind of poached chicken that you cook it. Imagine sort of cooking a whole chicken as if you were about to turn it into chicken soup.
Okay.
In stock. But you pull it out before it starts to fall apart. So it's beautifully juicy and cooked.
Mm.
Then you remove all the rubbery skin, because nobody likes that, or maybe some, but we didn't. And then you take those beautiful slabs of poached chicken meat, and then with some of the broth you can boil rice or you can boil potatoes, and then you turn it into a slightly lemony sauce that you pour over the poached chicken and the rice. And it is so delicious, I can tell you, because it's got all the flavor of a chicken soup, but it's like a deconstructed chicken soup.
I love how it sounds like a one-pot meal, using the whole chicken, all of its soup, and cooking look good. And, you know, I had a guest on this show, Tamar Adler, who wrote The Everlasting Meal. She was extolling the virtues of boiled chicken. So it's not as uncommon, perhaps. It's
well, I think you just
food.
Want to call it poached, and in our recipe, we didn't even know what to call this recipe, so we called it chicken in a pot, and it really is like a one pot meal, because you can also preserve the carrots and things, you know, as well, and then you're also left over with a whole bunch of homemade chicken stock, which you can then freeze. So that again, it's like also very practical. That's very Polish that you would have, you know, you could produce two or three meals out of, you know, one effort. And then the other meal we like, the kids love, is this soup. And it's called, in the book we call it, I think we call it sour bread soup or sourdough bread soup.
Yum.
And this, I had never, and Anne confirms this, you never see outside of Poland. But when you have it in Poland, you think it is the greatest soup you've ever had. And it is made from, it sounds gross, but stay with me, like a fermented, you take some classic sourdough bread, a couple slices, and you kind of ferment it for a couple of days. So you get this kind of runny juice from it. In some Polish grocery stores, if you're near one, you can buy it. It's called Żur, Z-U-R. Hmm. But anyway, it creates a sort of sour bread dough taste, and then the soup itself is like a almost like a slightly creamy soup with sausage and then this little bit of sour bread dripped into it, and it's really tasty, and they also will chop eggs up in it if they feel like it, but tastes like nothing you've had and yet is hearty and filling. And in Poland, they actually will serve it in like dugout bowls made of, you know, bread. But here, and it's very easy to make, and it just sort of knocks people out. And that's also something my kids will beg and plead with me to make.
That's really interesting. Wow. So we don't have that much time left, but I wanted to ask one last question. Perfect date meal? What is your ideal? Yeah.
Oh, the perfect date meal?
Yeah.
Oh, I've actually, yes, I know exactly. I encouraged a man. In fact, I've been telling, I've had to give this advice twice. We have a whole roast chicken, and it's actually in season. If you can still get clementines, or it's very simple. You can't screw it up. You just take a whole chicken and you shove some clementines in it, and then we tell you how to make a very simple reduced little sauce from the drippings.
Ooh.
But it's orangey and fresh, like wonderful to have when it's cold, and you know that wonderful citrus element when it's chilly. And people don't expect a roast chicken. It always seems like it's more work than it actually is. It's one of the easiest things in the world to make, but people think it's involved. So you really, really impress someone with that. And you can just serve it with a simple salad.
Wow, that sounds great. I should try that instead of lemons next time, the chicken.
Yeah, try it. If you can still find mandarins or clementines, you can absolutely use them.
Wow. Thank you so much, Danielle. This is so inspiring, and I just love the cookbook. Everyone check it out. It just came out recently, and if you're wondering what to do with the celery root, sunjoks, beets, cabbage, red cabbage, winter vegetables that are only in season right now, so definitely check out these wonderful recipes. That's about it for our show. Thanks again, Danielle.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Let's Eat In.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.